Okay, welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and I have here another fabulous panel assembled to discuss another esoteric corner of Mormonism. First of all, to my left is the lovely Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody.
Hello. And joining us again is Lindsay. Hey, Lindsay. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to have you here. And Brian, I'm not sure you've have you been on Mormon Expression yet?
No, this is my first.
Oh, well, I'll be gentle. Welcome. And this is your first trip to studio, fist in your face.
As well as my first trip to Lehi.
Oh, yeah.
And his first beer.
I've dreamt of this.
Just kidding.
It is pretty underwhelming. And joining us via live satellite hookup from the fabulous Las Vegas is the one and only Mike Tannehill. Hey, Mike.
It's a pleasure to be back.
It's a pleasure to have you, indeed. You know, Mike, I told this many times, but people still ask me if you're real.
I still wonder that, and I've met you.
Speaking of Mike, and this might be a good time, just like last year, Mike, I saw you joined the group up. Last year we took our inaugural trip to Las Vegas. We rented a bus and drove on down with a bunch of really awesome folks, and you met us down there. You partied
at Orleans.
You partied with the Mormon Expression crew. And so
it was really friendly and it was nice.
So for those of you out there in podcast land, mark your calendars. We don't have a date selected, but sometime
mark
at the end
your
of
calendars.
They just mark the whole damn thing. sometime near the end of September is like we'll be going. And Mike, you'll be there, right? I have your commitment.
I will.
Mike, will you be there?
I will be there.
Thank you. It will be a fabulous time. And we're looking at, in fact, chartering a bus from Phoenix and chartering a van from Boise, right, Lindsay?
As far as I know.
All right. Well, good times. Okay. So today, our last podcast, we talked a little bit about tolerance. And when we set that up, we were thinking about some related topics. And this one was actually the one that we were going to do first. Related to tolerance, because tolerance is this virtue that religious people, well, it's a virtue that religious people really want for themselves, but really don't want to extend to anybody else. Thanks for the courtesy chuckle, Mike. Because if you look at the First Amendment, religious people insist that they be given free rein to say what they want. But the First Amendment exemption to the First Amendment is pushed hard by religious folks, which means religions themselves are not subject to it. I'm not making this shit up. This is for real. So for example, if I'm a Mormon, I do not want anybody to not be able to hire me because I'm a Mormon. If I'm the Mormon church, I push very hard to make sure I have the right to not hire people because they are not Mormons. So it is a right that churches insist that they deserve out in the world, but they are not themselves subject to. Which leads us to our topic for today, which is persecution and the Mormon persecution complex. That's not exactly what we call this. We call this we left the question mark. Are Mormons persecuted? Right. And I guess the sub question is, are Mormons persecuted more than the basal persecution rate that everybody else runs into? So that's our topic for this evening. Now, we're trying to cover the faith spectrum. Mike, you went to church today, right?
I did.
Brian, did you go to church today?
I did, yeah.
Lindsay?
I did not.
How long has it been since you've been into a church?
Well, I went to the Community of Christ.
Not counting like when your covens are meeting.
Oh, that's a good way to word it. To a Mormon church, it's been probably a few weeks, but to my own ward, it's been about 2 years.
Wow.
I've got like full fledged inactive cred now.
So, and of course, Zilpha and I, it's been a long time. So I wanted to point out that we have this panel of five and we are in perfect harmonic balance. Two of us have been to church today. Two of us have not. And Lindsay, you're kind of in the middle.
Yeah, I bring you all together. Like a bridge. A bridge of Mormon faith and virtue.
And semi-activity.
Okay, so, let's start. Let's move right to left, shall we? Mike, are Mormons persecuted?
Today, it's Politically, yes. I'd say politically, but not compared to what it was.
So
what
you
do you
would
mean
say,
by that?
You would say politically, like Glenn Beck.
Well, with the gay marriage stuff going on, everybody calls us a bigot. We're horrible.
Yes, people. When we think about gay marriage, the first thing we think is that Mormons are persecuted. That's the first thing that comes to everybody's mind. So I'm with you. I'm with you on that one.
We're horrible bigots.
You bring up an interesting point that I want to come back to.
Oh, you forgot to mention that we have this active studio.
Oh, yes, we have a fabulous,
you
beautiful
hear extra
studio.
Giggling. That's what it is.
Okay, so you would say politically, but not maybe we need to take a step back. Okay, well, I still want to ask the question. So Mike says yes, but just on the political arena.
Well, if you compare us to Christians in Egypt right now, they're being killed and executed, but in America, we're doing all right.
Okay. So, not too bad.
Extreme.
Not too bad. Brian?
We have a little bit of persecution in other foreign countries where we have missions. I don't think we're persecuted in America.
Okay. Lindsay?
I believe that everything that we feel, we're really feeling, and it feels real, but I don't think that Christians are persecuted.
Oh, I like that. It's a real Viktor Frankl sort of answer. I like that.
Yeah, that's what I'm going for.
Mormons persecuted.
Depends on where you live.
Okay, so maybe, like...
Where there are very few Mormons, it'd be more likely that if people kind of have a general idea of what Mormonism is, but they're very rare. At least this is my growing up, that it was something that was... You could be made fun of for it,
okay.
Persecuted for it.
Okay. And my answer is yes, but no more so than everybody else. So, let's now dig into, because we're going to take the quiz at the end again, if I remember, and see if anybody changes their answer. Let's dig into what persecution is, especially what religious persecution is. And I think I can jump off of my answer. I think everybody in a minority, especially, well, okay. Everybody is made fun of all the time for everything. Is that fair enough? Like
if you grew up in my family.
Yeah. So across the political spectrum, I mean, just being in the majority doesn't exempt you from being a target of harassment or ridicule or satire or all those things. And this is where I really like the point you were making earlier, Lindsay, that some of that has to do with how you internalize it and how you take it. Whether or not you're being persecuted or not. But everybody is all the time. And some people are going to take that very hard. Like a child growing up in school, some kids can be subject to the same amount of bullying and it's just water off a duck's back. And other kids, it will send them into counseling until they're 50, right? Because it's how they internalize it. So there's that level of persecution, the neener persecution. You know, like Mormons have funny underwear persecution. Then there's like persecution that involves the spilling of blood or other sort of things where you get fired from jobs. You get, systematically, you can't serve in political office. You can't adopt children. You get divorced. You get thrown out of the community, imprisoned and
curb
killed.
Stomped.
So we're talking about social constraints.
I'm just throwing
that
out
at that point.
What do you mean by social constraints?
Well, a social constraint is a barrier that's placed in front of you from being able to kind of freely move forward, right? So it's a sociology term. When a social constraint is placed on you, usually by a dominant group or, you know, a group that has access to the most power, that's kind of what we're talking about in that level of persecution.
Okay. That makes sense because, and there's subvert and overt. Like, for example, as an agnostic, as an atheist, there's nothing barring me from running for political office in the state of Utah. But as a atheist, there's no way I can win an office in the state of Utah.
If that was known.
Yeah, based on the culture of Utah, sure.
Based on the culture of Utah. And this is where this whole question gets tricky, and this is why we're going to be able to spend an hour plus talking about it. Because whoever it is that's executing that persecution will define it as persecution or not. Because if I say I am persecuted because Mormons won't vote for me merely because of my atheism, I mean, they won't vote because I'm an asshole, but there are other people that couldn't get elected because they're atheistic, right? I think we're in agreement there, right? You can't come to office, at least if you're open and public about it.
I agree.
In the state of Utah. So the question is that, does that itself define itself out to be persecution? Because we're talking about religious belief. We're talking about a fundamental belief in deity, in theology, in religion.
I would think persecution would be something more overt.
Okay, so you're saying that the straw man I just put up, that doesn't count as persecution.
It'd be in your own head, but it wouldn't be something overt where somebody else could come in and say, oh, you're persecuted.
So, Mike, are you saying that the intent from the person who's doing the persecution, is that that's a necessary component?
Yeah, I would say it's something active in your face. You know, I don't see it as something more subtle like that.
But
using the word persecution.
But it is active. I mean, we're talking in this example that the people are systematically removed or not allowed to serve in public office because of their religious belief.
Before we start though, can I bring in intersectionality for a second? Okay, so like for an organization to exist, it has to be able to define itself why it's different from society or other groups, right? We define our organization this way because we're not like this or we are like this and it puts us apart, right? But when we factor in persecution, like you said, if you were going to not be hired or voted in, I mean, you're a white male atheist man. And if you were to strip that down and only pick one of those things, so you're like only an atheist man and you want to be identified only as an atheist man or only as a white person or only as a man. When Mormons do this too, like Mitt Romney, we say, oh, he's being persecuted because he's Mormon. But there are so many other identities to Mitt Romney than just he's Mormon. And so I think we have to factor that into the persecution too. Mormons as a whole can be persecuted for being Mormon, but there are other identities at play too. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree. And I think when we look at a population on the whole, then we can start teasing that out. We can say, you know, somebody who's Jewish can't get office in Boston or something like that. So then we can say, well, is that just a matter of personal preference? This is a democracy. Because democracy in and of itself can imply a certain level of persecution. And, you know, it's because let's go to Mike's example at the beginning. Prop 8 was purely a political campaign. So, Mike, when you were talking about persecution for Mormons in relationship to Prop 8, what did you have in mind? Do you have, like, the graffitiing of the temple, or did you have just the pushback from the political view?
But just the pushback from the political view, but I think that's going across all Christianity.
Mike, I just threw you a softball. I threw you the right answer, and you shat all over it. Go for the hate speech, man.
Promoting conventional morality is going to be persecuted by the rising tide of atheism.
There's a difference between persecution and disagreement, though, and I think that has to be sussed out too. Just because someone says your idea is stupid or I don't agree with it doesn't necessarily mean that you're being persecuted.
So you say the rising tide of atheists. Atheists, by all account, are a minority, and they're politically disenfranchised. We've already acknowledged that. How in the world do they persecute the majority?
You can't trust them with your kids. I know that.
Yeah.
They eat babies.
But that's still not persecution, except for the babies.
They're not going around burning swastikas on your lawn like my grandparents were. You know, like, I mean, my grandparents didn't burn swastikas. They had swastikas burn on their lawn. Sorry. Continue.
Yeah, it's an important distinction. So, there was a great – I put it on my Facebook wall like a year ago. There's a great quote. I had from some pastor somewhere, and he was talking about the rising tide of atheism. And his plea, his hope was, well, let's just hope that when they get power, they don't treat us like we treated them.
Okay, I know, though. I remember hearing stories of godless atheists trying to make us take the crosses down from highway patrolmen, you know, accident sites or whatever. We felt like because they were, like, forcing that church and state divide on us, that was a form of persecution.
Well, and just real quick, I think, you know, what we contend with atheism now, I think – a few generations ago was contending against communism.
Right? Yeah.
So, you know, so it's just kind of shifted the language now that the Soviet Republic is.
Well, and they in fact used like atheist as an adjective to describe
the
atheist communist, like it was a de facto, you know, self-apparent insult. Yeah. You know?
I still think that lingers though.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And one thing I think also that we need to tease out here is the difference between persecution at an individual level versus a social institutional level.
Absolutely.
I think that broadens the conversation out a little bit. And tribalism, how this fits into tribalism. If you don't mind, I do have a quick quote here. This is from Rational Wiki, and I think they did a great job at defining this. It says, the formation of a tribe in the sociological sense relies on there being a common interest or a goal strong enough that the group would in some way delimitate itself from the larger society. Persecution complexes are not inherent in all forms of tribalism, but they do lend themselves to a polarization of such groups. Communal reinforcement reassures group members that they are indeed correct. How could all of us be wrong?
Well, I agree with that. I do want to say that everything we've been talking about so far, I don't think counts as persecution. I honestly don't think the fact that I can't run for office in Utah does not qualify as persecution.
I wouldn't qualify it. I was going to give some examples. You're asking about the rising tide of atheism as persecuting the religious. There's a number of examples in Massachusetts where they've legalized gay marriage since 2004. And when churches are hold pro-traditional marriage events, that the...
Wait, who's tradition? What do you mean traditional? You mean like Abrahamic tradition?
Just man and a woman.
Well, whose tradition
is
that?
So not Joseph Smith. Then,
yeah, you can't just say traditional. You have to say my traditional.
Okay.
Post-industrialized Western society traditional.
Well, I mean, it's just late.
Outside these gatherings and protest and scream and hold the bullhorns against the windows and yell at the people inside.
Because okay, traditional marriage in the United States, we go back to the 18th century. The householder held all the political power. That the woman sort of surrendered her property and her voting rights and all that kind of stuff to the. So when you talk about traditional marriage, you can't even talk about traditional American marriage and talk about the bullshit you're talking about. You're talking a very short time frame, relatively speaking, right?
I think anybody that hears traditional marriage knows exactly what I'm talking about.
They know you're reading something off of the Tea Party's like talking punch list.
Sure, we've socially constructed that as traditional marriage, but
so,
you're right.
Wait,
it goes
no,
back
no,
to
no,
about
so
200
traditional
years.
Marriage, you know, like what we see on TV, like Kim Kardashian, just like in Kanye, right? Is that a good?
Yeah,
definition?
Like the Elvises cool. In Las Vegas. Yeah.
Good. Okay. Good. Okay. Go ahead. Just so we're good. Kardashian marriage. Go ahead.
I'm just saying they would hold rallies for that and to fight back against the tide and the protesters would.
I would have a bullhorn for the Kardashian marriage too.
Okay. So Mike, I mean, I just want to point out language here because language is so key. You said rally and protest. They're the same f-ing thing. You're just labeling one way and one the other, right?
The rally group is in support of something. The protesters are protesting what they're supporting.
The protesters are in favor of gay marriage. Your definition doesn't work.
The Osmonds at the Capitol in Utah here, we had an Osmond, not the Osmonds, like some Osmond no one cares about, show up at the state capitol and hold a rally protest in support of Kardashian marriage. So, like, it's the same thing. They had bullhorns and posters too.
Protest in support of. So wait.
Yeah. So still, okay, Mike, you're talking about the exercising of free speech, something I believe in. Protest has been with us on all sides of all issues from the beginning. I doubt there's any American who would say I am against protest.
And is protest a form of persecution?
Well, yeah. I still go to the point. We still haven't talked about persecution at this point.
Well, like, what is persecution?
But I rudely interrupted you, Mike. Go on, please.
No, I'm done. Go ahead.
So, if we go back traditional religious persecution, I want to start. We could go back. This is everywhere. But I mean, let's start with the Christians in Rome, right? The Christians wouldn't sacrifice to, basically to the effigies of Caesar. They wouldn't bow down to the effigies of Caesar. And so they were thrown into the Colosseums and torn asunder by wild animals, or may I say had worse things done to them that even I won't talk about here. That's persecution. That's religious persecution in my mind. I mean, that's an extreme example. The Nazi genocide was religious persecution. Cultural persecution.
So there has to be violence associated.
I think there has to be some sort of real interference. Now I would say that since atheists can't be elected, we still live in a secular society. If there was a systematic disenfranchisement of a group of people, and because I mean, let's face it. Every Christian out there is a de facto atheist. Like, right? They can say they like don't believe in science or evolution, but I mean, they'll take a flu shot, right? And use a microwave. So, I mean, let's see what they're really doing. So I don't buy into the whole atheists are really super persecuted thing, but there is systematic disenfranchisement of populations. And that does happen. And we can find instances of that and say, this is happening, statistically.
So then I think you need to redefine what violence is.
I agree.
Okay. How about you? You seem more,
how about I redefine
you
what
you
violence
seem better equipped to do that than I am.
Well, I mean, is it always a physical action where literally blood is drawn? Or are we talking about violence being, keeping a group of people from being able to have the same liberties or rights as the rest of society?
Yeah, I think the medieval Jewish ghettos are an example of what you're talking about, where they might not have been killing anybody, but, you know, they were walled into parts of the city. They weren't allowed access to certain goods or services. They were systematically kept down.
Well, I have a heart. I'm going to bring it back to my family again. I want to see if you think that this is persecution. So they came over during the war. And they were German, and they changed their name from Weiss to Weiss, so it sounded more American. And they had swastikas burned on their lawn and bricks thrown through their windows that said, Nazi, go home. Persecution or no?
Or is that racism or prejudice?
Well, it's persecution of their
What would it take to have to make that action a persecution?
I think to your point that you made at the top of the discussion, Lindsay, when you are talking about the psychology of it, because oftentimes these actions, they're designed to intimidate and get people to behave in a certain way. We really, as human beings, don't like to make people do things. We like to, like, corral them and have them do things that we want them to do. So we want them to move out of the neighborhood. We want them to leave us alone. We want them to not mess with our legislature. We want to shape the environment that we want to live in. And let's take something as simple. This is an issue oftentimes in the South, out here, where LDS people, and they're getting less this way. It's starting to annoy me, but they don't want you doing things on Sunday, right? Because they don't believe in doing things on Sunday. So they then extend that, and they don't want other people doing things on Sunday. So they will close down parks or swimming pools or stores or try to boycott things or get things shut down through the local city council. You know, that's because they're trying to shape this world. Because the rational response is, if you don't want to swim on Sunday, just don't go to the pool, right?
Sure.
But
they would argue that you are persecuting them by making, you know, your poor first counselor neighbor have to go to his Walmart job after church.
Right. That's the chicken shit argument.
But see, that's the point I'm coming to. Persecution, I think, we're talking about violations and laws. I do really think it comes down to how it makes people feel. I mean, Mike feels persecuted by a rally, right? Which is designed to push people in a certain direction. But I would say I would feel persecuted by having a brick thrown through my window.
Well, and in that sense, Mike will participate in the VIP lounge, the Mormon Expression Facebook group. There's 1,400 people in there, and there's like three real believers. Mike is one of them. And the rest of those 1,399 people, like a bunch of them will feel persecuted by Mike politely responding to something that they don't believe in. Like people get offended. People complain to me about Mike, and I'll go look at the post, and Mike was polite. He just said something that was stupid. But that's not a form of persecution, right?
Right.
I would count persecution as harassment that sometimes involves violence.
But you earlier you were saying that, so was it the blowhorn that made it more obnoxious? Is that what made the protest?
Do you think that a protest is persecution, a form of persecution?
Well, if they're having it at a city park, it's no big deal. If they're going to your church and coming in the building and yelling through the windows and won't let you leave, that's
something. So you felt like that was aggressive.
Well, I agree with Mike here that I think
I don't know if it's persecution, but it was harassment.
You look at some of those rallies outside of abortion clinics.
Westboro Baptist Church rallies?
Yeah, or that, for example. There are ways that even within the realm of free speech, or you're pushing the edge, that your behavior is considered harassing and intimidating and designed to really change people's behavior as opposed to changing people's opinion.
Right.
You know, when people protest abortion clinics, which was bigger in the 80s and 90s than it is now, it was to keep young women from coming in. That was their goal, is they wanted them not to have to run the gauntlet, right?
Right.
Obviously, they wanted the abortion clinic shut down, but they were going to keep to shut it down de facto. So that's a form of protest, but that's really a form of persecution. Mm-hmm.
I agree.
So, do you want me to give you the Wikipedia definition?
Oh, this please.
Is what they say. Persecution is the systemic mistreatment of an individual or group by another group.
So mistreatment's a little fuzzy, isn't it?
Well, I like Mike's word of harassment.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Another, the Free Dictionary says, to oppress or harass with ill treatment.
There
to
you
annoy,
go. The
persistently
part.
Bother.
My kids consistently bother me. Are they persecuting me?
Well, and a proactive, you know, it's
I
like.
I think that's part of it is the persistency of it. If it's just like a one-time thing that, you know, some group of people did against another group of people, I don't know if that can really be persecution.
Well, but you could have some Mormons gay curb stomp someone outside of a gay bar once. You know what I mean? That's not persistent. Homophobia is persistent, I guess,
yeah.
But where, you know, like the violence you're talking about, where that becomes persecution is because it's not a one-time act on one person to another. And this is why we have hate speech laws now, because, which I think
or
last podcast,
crime.
I said I didn't like hate speech laws, but, because the act is not necessarily aimed at the person who's receiving the violence, although they experience it. The act is aimed at everybody else. It's aimed at that intimidation. It's aimed at that cultural control. And that's where we really get into persecution. Okay. I think we've got a good handle here on what persecution is. So, are Mormons persecuted?
No.
Today, no. Formally, yes.
We talk about this, like, with rape culture, where you place the blame on the victim, right? You should never, like, someone says, oh, she was being a slut, she was wearing slutty clothes, so that's why she was raped. That's rape culture. It's blaming the victim. And,
uh-huh.
And it means no, there's no excuse for that ever. But I'm thinking with Mormonism, there have been times when it was provoked.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you see where I'm going?
No.
But I don't know how to suss that out.
We're going to get into this. So provocation is an important thing. Let's talk about, like, the starkest example in human history of persecution. Let's talk about Jewish people, right? So let's take a little walk down memory lane into the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, Christian values were a little bit different than they are today. And one of the big sins, one of the big things, was the sin of usury. Sin of usury is defined by the Bible, for all of you biblical people out there, is making interest off of anybody. The Bible expressly prohibits it. If you're a good Christian and you pay or receive any sort of interest at all, you are breaking God's law. And in the Middle Ages, they took this very seriously. And so, the problem is, if I'm a land baron, you know, in Lithuania, and I need to raise an army really quick, I don't have enough capital, well, all the good Christian princes and kings could not loan me any money. That was the Catholic Church expressly prohibited that. So where do you borrow money when you can't get money from anybody who's under the purveyance of the church? Well, there were Jewish folks, and they weren't allowed to keep property. That was another part in the Middle Ages. They just weren't allowed to have property. So they by force had to become a merchant class. And they would sell things, and they would sell things at a profit, and everybody would grumble about it, but they would do it. Just like we all do in America right now. I want to say this isn't very different. So they had capital. So the Jewish banking conspiracy, which I don't believe in at all, started because the Jewish families controlled capital that they would loan to princes because the Catholic Church basically prohibited anybody else from doing it. So there would become this system that was self-perpetuating. So then if you needed to borrow money, you would borrow it from a Jewish lender because they could do it. They had the capital. And then your loan would default. And then who did you blame? Well, now we blame the banks. But then in the past, they blamed the Jews, and then it would go on and have this cycle of persecution, and it would enhance this cultural war. So this goes to the point of there were external forces at work that caused this rift, this cultural rift that we still see today. There's still a huge anti-Semite culture, especially in Europe. If you go talk to Europeans, I hate to throw all my European friends, but those guys are really anti-Jewish to this day.
Or Northern Idaho, but.
Oh, yeah.
really the same thing.
So it's like, and I don't mean to, cause I'm playing off your rape culture thing, because the thing is to blame the victim. And the reason I bring up this example is because you can't really blame the Jewish bankers because they were a product of this system. And in fact, they're a product of the biblical system. But I mean, let's go to early Mormon history. What is the worst? Let's try to think of the one or two worst examples of persecution from Mormon history.
Well, we always bring up the Missouri persecutions.
Hans Mill.
Hans Mill, which, you know, was a terrible, atrocity, but we talk about, I actually asked, my wife today, God bless her, how many people died during the Missouri persecution? And I'd like to hear just a survey from you guys. How many people, and don't Google it, how many people do you think died during the Missouri persecution? Mike, don't Google.
On which side?
Mormons.
Mormons?
Off the top of my head, 30.
I'm thinking like 12.
I'm thinking that's, I'm trying to remember what the death count, what Hans Mill was.
Yeah, it was lower.
No, I'm talking Missouri.
Oh.
All of Missouri persecutions.
All of it?
Well, Hans Mill was the single biggest incident.
That was the biggest throughout all of Missouri's persecutions.
It's
B.H. Roberts said it was less than 50.
Yeah, and that sounds like a stretch to me.
Yeah. So,
I don't know how.
Hans Mill was 21, wasn't it?
Yeah, when we put it into proportional comparisons to, and we like to do this, right, as Mormons, we like to say, well, we were persecuted just like the Jews. And then we, and then we look at these numbers. I mean, not that numbers should be the entire thing to go by, but holy smokes.
Death counts. We want a death count.
Yeah, because the whole Missouri conflict and everybody gets the two Missouri conflicts, messed up in their mind. So let's make sure to decouple them. The Joseph Smith and company went down to try to convert the Indians and didn't work, but they found Zion along the way and they sent the early contingency down to Missouri. They didn't last very long. They were ridden out on a rail in about 2 years. But they took and they published some really inflammatory language in their newspaper, which is why the mobs went and attacked the press. They didn't like what was put there. And then they ran the Mormons out. Then the Mormons kind of resettle, and we're talking 4 or 5 years later. And this is when the battles come. Now, it's interesting that in Mormon mind, Missouri is this element of persecution. But in the history books, they're called battles, right? And the thing that set everything off was the Battle of Crooked River. And the Battle of Crooked River was set off by some Mormon raiders went and shot a judge in the stomach. And what historians on both sides acknowledge that there were border raids and scrimmages going back and forth between the two sides where they were burning down farms and
pillaging, raiding.
And when they talk about the Bishop's Storehouse in Missouri, this is where all the spoils were kept. And this is openly acknowledged by the early saints. Saddles and cattle. They would go into a farmhouse. They would take everything. They would chase the people off and they'd burn the sucker to the ground. And this was happening on both sides. So when you take that sort of view, It's like a gang war between the Bloods and the Crips. And it's really hard from an outsider to say, yeah, the Crips are persecuted. Cause they're in an ever-ending war of escalation. It's true. And things like Hans Mill were awful, but they were in retaliation for other raids that were done by the Mormons. And it's true. They were suffering. And I don't mean to reduce that, but there was suffering on both sides. And unfortunately, there's some Mormons who are really gleeful about this, but the whole place was sort of burned to the ground in the Civil War. So we lost a lot of the records of what happened on the other side. Like, it's not really clear anymore, what farms and stuff the Mormons were burning down because the whole place was burned to the ground basically later.
But we know of other nonviolent threats that the Mormons were. We know about their cultural, sexual threats. I mean, there were rumors that Joseph Smith, what's the word? What's a good word for this? Interested in other women from other towns. We know that they wanted political power, political gain. There was a threat of theocracy. I mean, there's
all kinds
of other things.
And they were open about it. I mean, let's be clear. They would come in and say, we are going to set up a theocracy. And what really set the Missourians off first is that open talk of, and here's all these immigrants. And these are poor, disenfranchised folks coming in and squatting on land, oftentimes illegally. And there was this real threat, like we see today. You can read London newspapers talking about the same thing coming from Islamic countries. This real threat that this disenfranchised immigrant population is going to take over the voting bloc. This is an age old story.
Can I just go from this book that I was reading. So I read this book from Candida Moss, who is a professor of early Christianity at Notre Dame. And she wrote a book called The Myth of Martyrdom. And she said that Christians have always had this persecution complex. But a lot of the narratives that we have told in Christianity are just ripoffs from the Greco-Roman tradition or Jewish tradition. We just like say that it happened to Christians. And she said that in modern day, the problem with asserting, and the Mormons did this, they would have these persecution narratives from the Bible, from restorationist like movements, and they would say, so now we're persecuted too. And she said the problem when you take an old sacred narrative like that and apply it to modern day is then it becomes prescriptive. It gives you like a way to do it. So that way, so then anyone who disagrees with you at all has to become your enemy because you need someone to be persecuted against, right?
Right.
Yeah. It's in group versus out group.
We saw this really starkly during the Bush administration, the second Bush administration. There was a point in the political history of the United States where the Republicans controlled the House, the Senate, the Supreme Court, the majority of the governorships, and the White House. And when you listen to them talk, they talked as if they were in the minority. And part of that comes from the fact they were in the minority for 40 years politically, but they couldn't get over that discourse. And you see that with Christians a lot, where Christians are in the majority of industrialized nations, at least Western ones. They wield a huge amount of power, but they sound like they're still like in Rome.
Well, because
right?
You benefit from the persecution narrative. Like, you know, Christians got a lot of tourism out of it. Mormons get a lot of tourism out of people go to Missouri. They go to Hans Mill to see it. I mean, we benefit in a lot of ways from this persecution complex, and that's just one of them.
Absolutely. And I think to build on that, a lot of the persecution for Mormons, a matter of fact, in my reading of history, the vast majority of it came from Mormons, right? It really wasn't external. You take like Kirtland, that was all an internal rift, you know, over the banking scandal, and it was they were fighting each other in the churches. You know, this wasn't like an external pressure thing. Even in Nauvoo, a lot of that was coming from disenfranchised folks who were
worried about the direction that Smith was taking things.
Right. Well, Missouri is where we got the extermination order,
right? And that's
from Boggs. But I mean, how many Mormons realized that we actually issued an extermination order against Missouri before they issued one against us, right?
Which is why Boggs. I mean, I'm not defending Boggs' action, but that's which is why Boggs did it because he had another one
in Far West.
Sidney Rigdon gave a speech on July 4th. It was actually an American, you know, celebration speech. But in it, he wrote, "We take God and all the holy angels to witness this day that we warn all men in the name of Jesus Christ to come on us no more forever. For from this hour we will bear it no more." Our rights shall no more be trampled on with impunity. The man or the set of men who attempts it does it at the expense of their lives. And the mob that comes on us to disturb us, it shall be between us and them a war of extermination.
Salt sermon?
Yeah, that's
a salt sermon. That's a salt sermon, yeah.
See, they were setting it up, though. They were saying, like, you know, it's us against the world.
If you read, like, especially the journals from people at the time talking about the kind of rhetoric in the churches. The church during those first, until the exodus to Utah, the church rhetoric was really, really over the top. For them, Jesus was just about to come and Jesus was going to kick ass. And, you know, they were telling people, you have to sell your farm and move to Kirtland because otherwise you are just going to be burned. And this really is externalized. Everybody else is an abomination. You know, I pointed out before that language appears a lot. That term has not like become worse over time. That's an awful term. And that's the way they were looking at and talking the world. So these preachers would go, these missionaries would go into these towns and basically insult and cajole everybody. And it just sort of pissed people off.
Well, and we were reenacting the narratives like with Moses and the Promised Land. I mean, we had those kind of narratives. Joseph had the Abrahamic tests he was giving people. Like, we were reenacting those same Christian narratives that we saw.
The Old Testament stuff.
Yes.
Right. And there's something to be argued psychologically that people, especially in young religious movements, basically cults, will keep pushing the boundaries until they get pushback. Because once they get pushback, they get validation from it.
Yeah, it solidifies their group, right? It creates a firm boundary of here's who we are because now we've got a them.
Right.
Yep, exactly.
And let me be clear. Mike just chuckled. I want to hear what he asked, what's going through his mind. But this is not a Mormon. Everything we're talking about here is not a Mormon thing to me.
No.
I think if you looked at the beginnings, the roots of any religious movement, you'd see these exact same actions, that provocation, that because if you form a new religion and your message is mamby-pamby, it's not culturally revolutionary. There's no point in joining. You have to be selling something new.
And you have to make it exclusive and hard to be part of, because the more you do that, the more cohesion's involved. And Mormonism has plenty of rites like that, especially the Temple Recommend, but we have baptisms and blessings and all these rules and now cultural constraints, and that makes us more cohesive as a group. But while that's good for Mormons, anyone who is fringe or on the outside, as many listeners know, it's not good for you because you become on the outside.
George Zimmel, sociologist, talks about the idea of a secret and how important a secret is to a group, right? And of course, Mormons have plenty of secrets, but I think that this is another one as John cracks open his beer. This is
and that's
very,
no secret.
Very subtly. This is one of those areas where there is almost like this secret inside of Mormonism. It's the we're persecuted. Right. And that creates another form of social bonding.
We have a term for it. We're a peculiar people. I can't say that word very well.
Well, that's another Old Testament reference.
Yeah. I think about a great example of that today is missionary work, where we dress freakish. Like to wear a white sleeve with a backpack and a helmet and your pants tucked into your socks on a 10 speed, but you just look weird, right? And then you go onto people's houses in the middle of whatever they're doing and bang on their door and ask them personal questions. Our mission president made a rule, this is a rule I gladly, fragrantly would violate. And I'm not making this shit up. From time to time, at least once a day, you would just knock on the door and you'd just start singing a song when they answered the door.
God.
You wouldn't say anything because then you'd get beyond language and they would just feel the spirit, you see. And oftentimes it's primary songs.
Why are
whatever.
They slamming the doors
still do
in
that.
Our faces? I don't get it.
So it's like we want to push the weirdness quotient until somebody slams the door and then, see, we tracked it all day long and not a single person
Let's
would listen
dust
to
our
us.
Feet with them,
yes.
Elder.
Well, and we felt the spirit when we were singing that primary song, and they obviously have something wrong with them, devilish.
It's okay, guys. They'll figure it out when they're burning in hell.
Yeah. Brother Tannehill.
Yes.
What say ye?
About
the peculiarity aspect.
Well, that's just...
Because Romney's weird, right? We can admit it. He's a weird dude.
Who's a weird dude?
I'm kidding. Go
Romney.
Ahead.
Oh.
Do you think Mormons
I'm struggling
take
a point to start from, but
okay. Do you think Mormons take pride in their peculiarities?
The whole thing John said about seeing a door is absolutely ridiculous. I don't know how that would ever work or ever get you in a door. You're supposed to be in the world, as meaning that you're not supposed to be strange, just not of it. That you're not joining them in using foul language or enjoying pornography. That's supposed to make you set you apart. Not
so why do Mormons
like
care if we're Christian or not, Mike?
Doorstep.
Why do Mormons care if we're Christian or not then? Why should
Christian
we give? Why should we give a flying flip what any Protestant says about us?
Not just a flip, Mike. A flying flip.
Well, we want to be seen as Christian, but we want to give our version of Christ.
No,
but
we want to be accepted. We want to be mainstream.
But why do we want to seem as Christian? I mean, I think it's a valid question. Like, why care at all? Why not just say, you know, we're Mormons? Because, and people should feel the Spirit. Like, the whole thing is a conduit to the Spirit.
You shouldn't have to sing.
Well, because without Christ, there's no true faith. So you don't want to say we don't believe in Christ. But at the same time, you say we don't believe in your Christ that's accepting of everything.
But what makes us peculiar?
Okay, so here's the thing. That Mormons both want to be accepted as Christians, part of the Christian community, and they want to be peculiar and refuse iced tea.
We want it all, Zilpha.
Like, why... How are they going
to
be accepted?
Having a Christianity that demands something of the people, those are actually the only successful Christian churches right now. These mega churches.
Agreed.
That are all accepting and come as you are and don't demand anything of their members. The people show up and leave. and don't come back.
That's exactly
but
what I'm
actually,
talking about.
Membership are the ones that demand something that people demand change.
But Mike, you said mega churches because they are mega and they have tons and tons of people. And they pay
they
lots
and
of money.
Nobody's staying.
But it doesn't matter to
there's
the
a core group.
To the church.
All right. So all this discussion so far is not interesting to me. I want to get to the interesting discussion. All right. You know, we've been talking about are Mormons persecuted and stuff like that, and are religious people persecuted? The answer is yes and no. And obviously, I mean, let's cut to the end chapter. Whoever's in power religiously persecutes whoever's not in power. And they, because of religious fervor, they think they're justified in it. They're doing God's work, blah, 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 blah. So, Mormons have been persecuted from time to time, but I think we've well established that it wasn't really that over the top comparatively. Like when you count the death toll for Mormons and then look at the West in general, I mean, they were on the border. They were on the frontier. Like the West was a lawless place.
And go down to Cedar City and ask, you know, those people did their own share of persecuting outsiders.
Right. Yeah. I think if you even took the history of Jackson County during that time and they weren't the majority of like murders and whatever at the time. It was
however many
place.
People were killed during Missouri, we more than made up for it with the Mount Meadows Massacre. Right.
Right. So, but the question is the interesting question. I'm just kidding. The first part was interesting. You all did great. Let's talk about the Mormon persecution complex for a little bit here. Because I think to seed the discussion, Mormons believe that they're persecuted. And not only do they believe they're persecuted, it's a useful belief for them. It's something that and we've hit on this a little bit, but I want to isolate that out. So Mike, do you think Mormons believe they're persecuted more than say the general population believes they're persecuted?
I think somebody pointed out the other day, somebody in the Viper room, that at conference you always hear this stuff about how negative things are and how bad things are and how we've got to overcome how bad things are today. And every conference, it's always getting worse and worse and worse. And I think that, like you said, it does play into a mindset that we're persecuted. But what Mormons feel persecuted about today is the moral relativism that's happening in society, where people are... What used to be hidden behavior is now carried with a banner. You got people.
We don't like
you know,
our feelings hurt when someone says we're a bigot.
Openly, using foul language openly. You go to any restaurant in town today, you're going to hear somebody cursing sitting there eating their lunch.
Mike, wait a minute.
What?
I've never heard you swear. Do you really not swear at all?
Me?
Yeah.
Because
this is the second time you brought up foul language. What about hell?
What if we ask your buddies at work, Mike?
What about damn?
Or are you talking about foul language more like boobs?
I hear it all the time just going like to a Jack in the Box to eat lunch and listening to talking line waiting to place the order. People drop enough balls. I hear that all the time. That you try to maintain in your own home and you step out and all the things you hold of value are being torn down by what you see. Just walking through a Walmart.
Dude, I totally know what you're talking about. I saw some gay people just tearing down one of my churches yesterday. It was so offensive.
Okay,
in
so...
In short shorts and everything, and they were hugging.
So here's the deal. And Mike, I think I know what you're talking about. Now, I have a working theory that we really have kind of like two different phases of persecution. So there's the early church persecution narrative, right? That...
Which is bombarded. We're constantly.
Yeah, you're taught it from a very young age that we received persecution. We had to flee out of Missouri, and we're also taught that it was because of our religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And we were faithful through it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the narrative that we're taught. That's a construct that's kind of embedded in us from a very young age. Now, the second phase of this, I think, and I'm going to argue, comes out of the Cold War era. And it's something that we saw in a lot of curriculum in the church.
Kimball.
Again, it gets back to that. Yeah, and I actually did bring something, a 1964 Institute manual with specific language on the changing values of America. So what we've done is we've gone from a physical persecution complex to a value persecution mm-hmm. complex.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
And again, that's where I think that...
Mike says, yes, exactly.
I like what you're saying. I want to take it a few steps back. The persecution complex... became extremely rhetorically important to Brigham Young. And when the saints were in Utah, so if you think about the immigrants coming across to Utah, they usually had to sell everything they had, and then they were out in this barren wasteland, and there had to be good motivation to not pick up and go to California. And so the rhetoric from, let's say, especially picking up in 57, And all the way to statehood in 96, we're talking about the 1800s. It was a very persecution, isolationist language. And of course we know that Brigham Young was duplicitous. He would say that in conference. Meanwhile, he's working for statehood. But, you know, they were very much setting up their own kingdom and the rest of the world was going to be burned shortly. And it got amped up during the Civil War, and especially the preamble to the Civil War all through the 50s. And that there was this real us and them, and we're getting persecuted by the outside world. And anything that would happen, you know, if they'd send a new battalion to stay at one of the forts or whatever, the conference speakers would use that to their advantage. Well, that had become such a rhetorical crutch to establish identity. When the twin things happened, that we got statehood and we got rid of polygamy, we suddenly lost that persecution crutch. And the church sort of went through, and it's actually this glorious time.
Well, I'm going to push John, back they on were that persecuted side. From the time they settled until like 1933. They were the one of the twin relics of barbarism that everyone in America.
Yeah,
hated.
Let's talk about the Reed Smoot hearings.
I agree with you. Up until World War I, there was this sort of no man's land. And the church itself, if you read church rhetoric from the time, they were floundering. They didn't really know what to go on. There was still, of course, post-manifesto polygamy going on. You know, if you went down to Levan or whatever, it was just like it was 50 years ago. But the wars came along, and then the Depression, and then we jumped into this Uber America thing.
Sure.
And the church kind of flatlined. If you look at like conversion rates and missionary and all from World War I to World War II arc. But then we hit our stride with the Cold War. And we talked about that before. Then we could revamp that persecution complex because now we had a new enemy. Before it was the U.S., right? And now it was the Ruskies.
With the U.S. against the Ruskies.
Right, yeah. We became flag waving.
The U.S. team.
And we sort of adopted that during the wars, but it just was this rhetorical perfect storm. And that, the 1960s were this heyday of Mormon persecution, and growth and all this kind of stuff.
Wait, heyday of Mormon persecution?
Of persecution rhetoric. I'm sorry.
And it's true. And that's when we start having the intellectual feminists start coming out with the ERA and that kind of thing.
Yep. We mentioned this last week. All the counterculture, because what Mormonism really became, especially centered at BYU, was the counterculture.
Yep. And so we had this sense of persecution from within and without.
Yeah. And then so you start looking at different things like educational institutions. Right. And you start feeling like your members are being taken away value wise because they're being liberalized in educational institutions. Right. So this is one of the things that came out of that institute manual. It said that the young Mormon is often faced with a new kind of challenge. He becomes more seriously concerned with the problem of adequate academic preparation for his future life. This new intellectualism, which suddenly confronts him, requires his constant reevaluation of old assumptions and old ideas. The young scholar is trained to accept nothing simply because someone said it and to search for truth by making conclusions for himself on the basis of available evidence. And it's saying this negatively.
Wow.
Oh, we still hold to that. Progress is persecution.
Yeah, and it says it's only natural the young Mormon will apply the same pattern of thought to every important value in his life, including his faith.
Whoa.
That's exactly what Mike's saying.
Well, that's what happens.
That's what Mike is saying. He's saying that these new ideas and these new things, everything's becoming commonplace. That the idea that we think that it's harmless that two men get married and, you know, adopt a daughter is
and
harmful.
Kiss.
And kiss. A lot.
What's funny is you're right, because and remnants of this survive not only in Mormonism but evangelicalism, that to go to a biology class and be told like biological information that doesn't jive with your weird religious views
don't
is a form of persecution. They're weird. They're bizarre. They don't make any sense. I'm not going to give them any deference. But you read stuff in the 60s and like that's when the counterculture, and you had to be clean shaven. And you can read where they talk about a young woman showing up to whatever they called it. There's a lot of letters. YMIA, whatever. Young men, young women, mutual association. Like if you showed up wearing a miniskirt in 1967, you weren't just not keeping the prophet standards. You were persecuting everybody else in that room by wearing your damn miniskirt.
1960s, that still happens today.
Yeah. And it was this Good really
nuts.
Reversed.
Skinny jeans.
Perversion of that not only we reject pluralism completely, and not only are we rejecting any sort of pluralism, but in fact your very existence in our closed society is a form of persecution to us. It's a very dangerous way of thinking, and it's the sort of thing that was fueling Nazi Germany and many other movements just like it.
Well, but then you have to do what Mike is doing. You have to all of a sudden reinvent or recreate this narrative that your organization has always been this perfect way, and we can't stray from that in any way.
We have always been at war with East Asia.
Exactly. Mike, you giggled at my... I'm not saying the Mormons are about to start doing what the Nazis did. I'm just saying that sort
of... The Nazis were born out of a liberal movement, not a conservative one.
Conservatives are people that hold to an idea of... that resist progress. And that, which is what you're doing. I'm like, you're resisting progress. You see progress as persecution.
Okay, Mike.
And tattoos and sexual indulgence isn't progress; it's regression.
The Nazis.
Regression to what? Like apes? Like
animals?
Like so? Are you making a case for evolution, Mike? Is that what we're doing?
And also, do animals have tattoos?
He's saying that only the missionary position is acceptable. It all goes back to
I'm pretty sure animals do all kinds of stuff.
Oh, that's why it.
And
Mike's
so can human
the
beings.
Now, see, the schools, like the colleges and stuff, and the conservatives are finding this out, that when they send their kids away to college, they're coming back liberals.
Being educated.
Yeah, exactly. Mike, we're not going backwards.
This, like, last week.
Mike, we're not going backwards. If you know anything about human history, you know that homosexuals have always been around, that we've been doing all kinds of crazy, kinky, weird, fetishy crap forever, probably worse than what we know now. The only difference is the internet has made it more available.
Look at the Kinsey Report.
Look at the Kinsey Report.
Yeah. What about
every
it?
Every single survey that they did, it was 3% of the people they interviewed that would sit through an interview like that. 3% of those willing to submit themselves to that garbage admitted that they were gay. That's 3%. That's nothing. That's an aberration. And now everyone is claiming that it's something to be normalized when it's obviously an aberration.
It's about 300% more than the Mormon population, and yet we want to normalize Mormonism.
So as a form of acknowledging what we're talking about in terms of persecution, you just called homosexuality an aberration. In terms of tolerance from last week and persecution from this week, Mike, I make you president and Supreme Court justice tomorrow. What do you do to the homosexuals?
Well, you don't grant them marriage because marriage, by its very definition, is not what they want. I mean, okay, if they want to do what they want to do in private, fine. But when you come into my school and want to teach my children how to mutually masturbate, and when you want to teach my kids...
I missed that class.
That's completely different. That's in my face. Instead of you just having a belief, now you're having an action, and you're making me accept your...
I want to point out to everybody listening right now that Mike would be classified as a liberal by almost everybody up to about 20 years ago, based on what he just said.
That's
so in your terms of progress, even Mike Canahill is saying, let them live, let them be.
That is a form of tolerance.
Because it wasn't that long ago the Supreme Court was talking about cases, like 10 years ago, cases where the cops, which was the case in Texas where they kicked in the door, found two men engaged in an act of love. And threw him in jail.
Are you talking about your sodomy laws that they just overturned?
Mike, I will not allow you to disparage things that I love dearly. Do
Mike,
not
what do you think of Japanese
tone.
People? What do you think of Japanese people?
Are you talking about the tentacle porn?
I'm just talking about Japanese people.
Not porn. No porn.
Japanese, we're not talking about fetishes here.
Japanese people, why?
Because we are like two generations removed from our great grandparents that put them in camps, in prison, in the state that I'm sitting in.
But
okay, and you're saying it's wrong. That's called progress. Look at you, you freak liberal.
the problem is when they want to start making laws to make me accept, if they want to criminalize disagreement and require state-sponsored propaganda of their ideas in
okay,
my schools.
I understand and I different. Agree that I understand your position that you shouldn't grant them legal rights. Okay. You're saying there's moral grounds for not granting gay people legal rights. But would you say that's a form of persecution against gay people?
No, because they're demanding rights they never possessed. We're not taking anything away from
polygamy.
Them. We're telling them no.
Look at what we did to the Mormons.
What you never had in the first place.
So, I mean, the women didn't have the vote up until the, 100 and whatever years ago. So
we got Obama.
Wow.
So
I love you, Mike.
As long as you've never had a right,
then you don't deserve one.
So
is that what you're saying?
Joseph Smith, when he applied for the ability to marry people, was denied that right because the local magistrate, I can't remember the details, basically said they weren't a church, they didn't deserve that right. So you're saying you would side with the magistrate. The magistrate shouldn't have granted the Mormon church the right to marry people because they'd never had that right in the past.
What about
what grounds was they weren't a church?
What?
Well, because
what
it was
say they weren't a church.
It wasn't a traditional church, Mike.
What about before rites were invented, Mike?
Right person.
No, I'm serious. Let's talk about basic American rights. What about when you had the right? You didn't have the right to free speech.
Stance that all men are born with a what's the word I'm looking for? God-given right.
The biblical stance says some people are, acknowledges slavery as a legitimate system.
So I don't see how marriage falls into that category, like how we're defining that.
Because marriage is a covenant between a man and a woman on how they're going to nurture their children.
No, that's your definition.
Mike, that's not even a biblical definition.
What amendment is that?
It's not an
amendment. What chapter in Leviticus is that?
See, and that's the thing with polygamy too. I mean, it was shut down for moral reasons. Everybody else thought we were morally wrong for doing it.
So, Mike, I want to ask you a legitimate question. All kidding aside, biblically, morally, and legally, I should be able to have concubines, right?
Yes.
Hell yeah.
So okay. I love Mike.
So we defended it. There we go.
And mutual masturbation classes.
In your system,
made to go together.
Right. I can have right. several.
Well,
in your moral system,
argument.
I can have several concubines, and that would be moral and legal and just. But Zilpha can't have a wife because that would be immoral, illegal, and unjust.
Correct.
You can have a sister wife, Zilpha.
All right.
Yeah. That's
so
all I
so
get.
The fact that people because you talked about protest to go full circle, the fact that people are not allowing you or want you to not be able to exercise that right is a form of persecution. Careful, you're walking into a trap.
Repeat the question.
But it's been carefully constructed.
Repeat the question.
There's no way out.
Do it again.
So
it's a tolerance trap, so we're good.
You talked to the top of the podcast about these protests in New York, and you were giving them as an example. They were protesting for gay rights. Right. And you just define that for you or for LDS people, or for religious people, they might have something that's not even legal because we've been blurring the lines between religious and legal. And you might have some like biblical belief that may not necessarily be constitutional. But for people to deny you the ability to practice your religious belief, even though it's not constitutional, you would define as a form of religious persecution.
Wow, that was convoluted.
It's getting in your face and there's violence involved.
Wait.
So, you can sell your daughter into sexual slavery, and that's cool.
No.
All right, I've got a great example, because it's a real example.
Okay.
What if I make a law that says all marriages in the United States are, because marriage is a contract between two people and society, all marriages must be performed in a public place? Would that law be a form of religious persecution? No violence.
Don't they already demand it because you have to have witnesses?
Not in the United States. In other countries, they do. The weddings have to be done in a public place.
Public place.
Oh, where the community can say we support this union.
Yeah.
Is that a form of religious? Because it's a religious tenet for Mormons that does not happen. So if I were to deny the state of Utah that right, would that be a form of persecution?
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
I just remember at my wedding, there's all these people gathered together to witness the event. And so I just assumed it's public because you have so many people.
Was it in front of an Arby's? This is important.
Was the guy wearing an Elvis suit? No, I
Elvis suits in the temple.
Okay, so.
Well, they kind of are close. Right.
Just need a little bit more sparkle.
Yeah, just not,
bling,
not
a little bit of bling.
That's an inside joke. Let's see. Okay, so I think to sort of start moving this thing down towards the its painful conclusion is that religious people tend to draw this big circle around themselves, and that's their persecution bubble. And this goes with what we talked about last week with our tolerance bubble. And to sum up for those who didn't hear, we basically said when people switch positions, like let's say they go from religious to non-religious, they actually don't become any more tolerant. They just we tend to tolerate a certain degree out from ourselves, and there's a bubble around us, and we just took our bubble with us. So what we tolerate is really a function of where we are. And I think persecution tends to be the same way. We take our beliefs with us, and then we do this bubble around us. And then when people infringe on that, infringe on our sensibility, it may not be anything that infringes. Like, Mike lives a happy religious existence in Las Vegas, right? I mean, he's able to exercise his religion, and all this stuff going on the Strip, Mike lives out in Henderson. He doesn't care. It doesn't bug him. It doesn't affect stake. And the problem is with religion, I think, is that it takes that bubble and it pushes it out. And there's good reasons religions do that. We've already talked about that.
Trying
it helps
to control
establish
their
cohesion
environment.
And an us and them environment and this narrative, the Willie Martin handcart company.
Sure.
It has nothing to do with persecution. That's bad management, but we've idealized that and turned it into this persecution narrative.
But it's even bigger. It's persecution by the devil.
Well, by God. God controls the weather.
No, well, not Mormons think that actually the devil works in all kinds of mysterious underground.
Well, when it's against us.
It is frozen water. Huh?
Ah, there you are.
You put Alexi Azevedo song behind anything and it becomes persecution, I'm telling you.
See this, that things like happiness and freedom and tolerance all have to work in a context. Does that make sense?
No.
And so we take our context of how we view freedom and happiness and tolerance and apply it as how we see things from our perspective.
Right. It's always in context.
Yeah, but all the greatest ills have been done in the name of God for other people because they say, that my context says that your context sucks.
The trick is to step out of your paradigm and see the bigger picture of things.
Well, I think religious people are the worst offenders probably because they've had the power, right? Persecution comes from those in power because
and the vigor. I mean,
the minority can't persecute. You take Judea at the time of Christ. They would throw stones and stuff, but the when the Romans wanted to send in the legion, they could wipe it
down.
Out. So there's a certain amount of power that has to be to execute on your persecution complex, which is why Christianity has been such a violent religion. Because you mix that persecution complex with the power that they wielded in the West, and you have blood spilt from one end of the globe to the other.
Especially when you're talking about colonialism.
Right.
Right? Because in colonialism, you've got a small minority of people, quite literally, but you've got a gigantic power that backs it up. Right? Mm-hmm. And can spill blood very quickly. But, and that keeps the group imposed on.
So I'm going to forgive Mormons to some extent, but where I have no tolerance is the church itself, the institution. And this is the real, we talked about persecution, where it comes from, all that stuff. The real sin in my mind that's happening in all this is the church's constant using this to manipulate the psychology, especially of young people. And I think that's where this is grievous. Cause we can talk about why Mormons think they're persecuted and how they use that in the political arena and all that kind of stuff. And whatever model we come up there, we can apply to other groups that are the same size and whatever. We can define everything going on in the Middle East in terms of great big persecution, revenge complex sort of things. But when you have an institution like the church that's systematically in a very corporate way, retelling these narratives and reshaping their museums and their magazines and everything to pump up. And that Martin's Cove out there is completely about that, and making those kids go walk and pull those carts and just do things just to install in them an air of persecution. That is where we have, somebody said I referenced 1984 every podcast, but you guys did it first. So you drew first blood. That's where we have that constantly keeping us at war with Eurasia thing, constantly keeping us in a threat, constantly saying, look at what was done. Look at what's going to be done again. Because it's always the once and future persecution, right? What happened to Martin and Willie will happen again. And you can find, especially Hick Mormons, they all believe they're going to take handcarts back to Missouri.
Hick
Mormons.
Gosh, my family.
Well, the reason I say that is because the people who represent the church, a la Joanna Brooks, tend to be very liberal and very and very cosmopolitan, foolish. And they don't represent the church in the pews. Go ahead,
Mike. Did you say foolish?
I said foolish.
Mike, are we going to walk back to Missouri?
That's not till after the American Civil War happens again.
Okay, so yes.
That's like,
for the record, Mike's answer was yes.
Years.
But not until Obama comes to your door and takes away your guns first, huh?
And makes you marry your male neighbor.
That'll never. There would be a Civil War.
So, to rein it back in
can
just
I
a little
watch,
bit.
Can I watch, Mike? Can I watch?
Another aspect of this, and Mike, I think you would agree with me here. Another aspect of this is how we see Mormons being depicted, right? So we call that persecution, right? How we're depicted by the media. 46% of Mormons believe that we are discriminated against by the media when they were polled. All right, so, you know, let's talk about that for a brief second here.
Does that have to do with the fact that most Mormons are conservative?
Are what?
Conservative.
I don't know, does it?
You mean, is that why they feel...
Conservatives, that they, we feel we're being conservative?
Well, that is less than half.
Well, I think Mike has a good point that the American conservative movement has its own persecution complex. And I think that's part of the Mormon thing, is you've got these two rivers running together, these two persecution complexes compounding each other.
Sure, and we can talk about popular shows, right? Big Love, them showing a temple, you know.
Is that persecution,
oh, yeah,
though?
So, but would a lot, that's my question, would a lot of Mormons consider that persecution?
Do you
because
think so,
it's.
Mike?
Yes, because it's, well, waving our sacred.
I want to know what Mike thinks about that.
When you see traditional values mocked and made fun of.
Was it mocked and made fun of? Did you see that episode?
With the
Big Love? Episode with the temple ceremony?
No, I never did.
Okay. Well, they weren't making fun of it at all.
South Park?
Okay. That's different.
Is that
that's
persecution, different. Though?
But we love it.
How about the Book of Mormon musical? Is that persecution?
Mental persecution.
See, here's what Christine Haglund says. She says that Mormons don't have a very good rubric at all in distinguishing the nuances between being poked fun at in the Book of Mormon musical versus that guy that was calling us a cult.
Or
the Harold
Reverend?
Bloom article.
Uh-huh. I think part of it is Mormons are very intelligent people, but they're so busy, they tend to do a ton of navel-gazing. And the problem is when an article surfaced on the New York Times talking about Mormons, they scrutinize it and look for anything that can – but they don't read every other article in the New York Times about religions. They tend not to look and say, what is – and this is – I used the word basal in the beginning. What is the baseline rate of persecution for any political religious movement? Like, because my argument would be – everybody's persecuted to some extent. That's the society we live in. Really interesting question is, are Mormons persecuted more so than everybody else of their peer group?
Somebody did a study of this for Dialogue, or no, excuse me, Mormon Matters when it was a blog, and they actually did Google searches on different religious terms to see how often it came up in a negative light, and it was a pretty extensive search, and I think Mormons came up about number 5 on the list overall.
Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses take far more crap than Mormons do.
Well, and
I would think.
And being misrepresented in the media or satirized in the media, that's not the same thing as persecution either.
No. No. Yeah, and I think Mormons would tend to frame all that stuff as persecution.
Do you think that there was a rise of persecution complex during Mitt Romney's campaign?
I think there was that, but mixed with this elation, I think a lot of Mormons were very optimistic about it.
I think it was more like when you scare a cat and all their fur goes sticking up. That's how Mormons felt. They were just like on edge.
What do you think, Mike?
I think it just had to coincide with the fact that it's being talked about more. So if it's talked about more, then the mocking goes up as well as the positive.
Yeah, I would agree with
that. What do you think of that Bednar quote I sent, or article I sent you? Did you read that, Mike?
Yeah, where he said if Romney comes to power, then the persecution is going to go crazy.
Like the worst that we've ever seen in our generation.
I think he was right. I think the church really did not want Romney.
I think the church wanted it.
No, not the membership maybe, but not Salt Lake City.
Yeah, that's probably.
I think they were shit in their pants. As when he got the nomination, because it was just going to shine this great big spotlight on Salt Lake City, and it was going to turn every conference into a circus. And the church dodged a big bullet on that one.
Yeah, Brother Kirby from the Salt Lake Tribune, the 13th Apostle, responded to that actually, and I thought he did a brilliant job. He said, people have tried to kill me for other things, including mainly just because I'm me, but never because of my religion. Pity. It's possible I'm missing an important faith-promoting experience, religious persecution. I'm hearing fellow Mormons speculate that Mitt Romney's bid for presidency could result in a major social backlash against the church. We might be persecuted again. For proof that demonic forces are stirring again, they point to an increase in mean-spirited comments about Mormons in newspapers, online anti-LDS diatribe, and people who say they'd sooner vote for a Martian than a Mormon. None of these things really counts as persecution. They're barely even discriminatory. This is America. People are perfectly entitled to not like us. Hell, I'm Mormon, and I don't always like us. The concept of being persecuted is deeply ingrained in most faiths, sometimes to the point of religious ordinance. Hey, you can't really be the true, quote, faith, unless you've been made to suffer for God. But there's a huge difference between being genuinely persecuted and simply being disliked. A persecution complex is dangerous. It's almost always the precursor to becoming the persecutor. Amen, Brother Kirby.
Yeah, yeah. Which is one of the chief complaints of ex-Mormons, right? That there is a huge backlash, and we've talked about that before. And people suffer in real ways, in ways that I dare you to find out there to my faithful listeners. I dare you to find 20 people who've lost their job in the state of Utah for being Mormon. It would take me 15 minutes to find you 20 people who've lost their jobs for leaving the church. So that's a real example of religious persecution by their own definition. And it's alive and it's out there and it cuts both ways. Mike, do you think Mormons persecute people?
I'm sure they do.
Yeah. And
show up with tattoos at a Mormon meeting and see what happens.
That's great.
My wife has tattoos and she's a young woman's president.
Are they covered?
Does she ever get
on her face?
No. They're not Maori. No.
Is it on her arms?
But it's okay because it's a strawberry shortcake. So.
Oh, that is okay.
Yeah. So it's too cute to be persecutable.
So what's going to happen in the future? I think this sort of can wrap it up. I think, you know, conservatives like Mike like to look to this once and future persecution, like I said, and a lot of religious movements look to this all out. I mean, it's a very, very common thing in a lot of religions. There's a lot of sects of Buddhism that have that. There's a lot of Hindus who believe in that sort of thing. It's obviously Islam. It's a huge thing. A lot of evangelicals.
To Christians, especially in America, happiness is a moral state. And as they see the world getting immoral, then they're going to feel persecuted as to what makes their lives happy.
Good thing they've been perpetually doing that for hundreds and hundreds of years.
But Mike, the advantage that my side has, and I'm talking about the devil, the advantage that we have is that you guys keep adopting our standards.
Slowly.
So, and whatever standards we have, you will adopt. So it diffuses persecution.
We call that progress.
Yes.
So Durkheim, another sociologist, defined social cohesion as morality. And basically the way that he saw it is that it didn't matter what the morality was that society adopted, that was all, kind of subject to culture to culture. Right. But as long as they had a unified morality, then they had social cohesion.
Yeah,
so I think what Mike is saying is he's saying that breakdown of that morality, which he believes is the dominant morality of America, is the breakdown of our social cohesion as a country. Am I right, Mike?
Yeah, that was very eloquent. Thank you.
Yeah, I think as an example of that, there are very few societies, religions that are against killing people. They're all against murder. And what's murder? Murder is killing somebody when you're not allowed to. So you take something
when you're especially pissed off,
right? Yeah. Something that we think we go to. What's the worst thing you can do? You can kill another human being. But every religion, every culture, every society, with a couple noted exceptions, will allow for it. Just you can kill as long as the prophet tells you to kill, right?
Or
otherwise,
government.
It's murder. And I think that's I'm just underlying your point that it's not this morality is never an abstraction. It's never this laundry list of things that are wrong. It's what we tell you, what the in-group says is wrong.
It's a construct. And the thing that's happening right now is that morality is shifting, and that's uncomfortable for the people that don't want it to shift.
But it will shift. It always has been. Now, I think it's accelerated by access to information.
So that breakdown that we're talking about, that breakdown of these morals, Mike, that is what you see as persecution?
Well, yeah, when it's one thing to, you guys think the way you think over there, and we'll stay over here and think the way we think. That's the way America was originally designed. You have different states where these guys that
pluralism
hang out here, you'll hang out over there, and we'll all be fine and happy. But what's going to happen is now that same-sex marriage is being legalized, well, now it has to be normalized, and they're going to do that through the school system with our kids like they've been doing.
Where are you getting this from?
A cross-dressing man showing up to elementary school.
Okay, so, with the mutual masturbation, Mike?
That's an issue. That's a real problem. Now you're in my face.
Okay,
well, nobody's doing that. When did that happen to you last, Mike?
So you say
it's Las Vegas.
Cross-dressing. So you're saying the government should give a list of approved clothing by gender to make sure that I don't even know what you're talking about. Well, cross-dressing. There's a moral code on what you wear.
There is this thing called a kilt. It's very traditional.
Different kinds of families.
Cross-dressing.
200 years ago, men wore high heels.
I think to the overall point, persecution complexes come with irrational fears. Can we? And I would categorize what Mike is saying as a very irrational fear. I'm sorry, Mike, but that's
completely... happened. I'm not making it up.
I would say
a news story.
You know what? Weirdos do weird things all the time. Mormons, I could tell you stories of Mormons do stuff too. Okay?
I've got 11 others just like that.
You can't base trends on weirdos.
I think irrational is the right word, but irrational in the true sense of the word. It's not based on rationality.
I was pulling it out of my butt and making it up. This is events that have happened in schools where they're trying to normalize a perversion.
Where did you get that information?
It's a list of news events that happened in Massachusetts.
It's a list?
You can be happy, Mike, because they still beat up gay kids every day at schools. They still ostracize gay kids every day at school.
So, and there's a real list of those.
Yeah, and there's plenty and plenty. And those kids are still committing suicide, so I think you're fine.
Now, Mike, what you had brought up earlier is you talked about this country was formed on pluralism. Is that right?
Yes.
So do you think that it's possible to still have a pluralistic society if gay marriage was legal?
The problem is when they want to tell you that it's right and that it's good. That's the change.
Okay,
you don't have to believe that.
We have a truce point.
Yeah.
Mormons can do whatever they want. They need to stop fucking telling me what's right and wrong. Just do what you're going to do and quit saying you're the one true church. Just say, we're pluralistic. This is what I want to do.
And I'm going to do it.
As soon as you guys buy into that standard and stop defining what is right and wrong, because the whole movement that you're part of, Mike, is based on the one thing that you said you don't want to have happen, which is tell us what to do based on what's right and wrong. You're in, I'm in. You guys stop doing that and the rest of us will come right along. And I can speak for every gay person in the United States today, and we are on board. You stop telling us what's right and wrong, and we'll have a happy pluralistic society.
Yeah, that's the whole point, though, is...
This rant brought to you by Blue Ribbon.
They would legislate to me through government power that I can't say that homosexuality is wrong. Now we got a problem.
No one has said at all, I do not know anything saying you can't say that homosexuality is wrong. All people are asking for is that right. And this goes to the heart of persecution. This goes to where we were talking about the definition. I don't think persecution, although religious people think persecution has to do with rhetoric. It doesn't have to do with rhetoric. It has to do with this, like you define, harassment, this violence, this interfering, constraints, this
constraint. Police are one thing. When it becomes action, now there's a problem.
I agree. And the action is we have this set of defined rights, marital rights, that we are going to deny to a set of a population because we do not like their private behavior. That's persecution.
But when it becomes public behavior, now is there a problem?
It's already against the law to blow somebody in public, Mike. You're not really talking about that. I don't care if you're heterosexual or homosexual. No one's talking about public behavior.
If I had my druthers, Mike, it wouldn't be, but.
All right, Mike, thanks
Enough
again.
Said.
Thanks again for coming on. As always, this discussion and others continue on our website at MormonExpression.com. Mormon Expression is a product of the Whitefields Educational Foundation and is made possible through your generous support and contribution. It supports this and other fine podcasts. And remember, Las Vegas, I'm going to pimp it between now and then. We're about 6 months out. It'll be a blast. Any other last thoughts that don't circle us back to something we already talked about?
I think it's over
and
out.
Brian, Mike, Lindsay, Zilpha, thanks again.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
So we ended
on
a blowjob joke.
Thank you, Mike.
Awesome, Lindsay.
We couldn't go any higher. I mean, there was nowhere to go after that.